The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jenna Walker for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. I'll be reading today from Money Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and Kiplinger's. We have run out, for the next half hour I'll be reading from Wall Street Journal, Kiplinger's, and Money Magazine. To start with, from Kiplinger's. This is the June 2022 issue. Or that's when the article was written, and it's by Emma Patch. ABLE accounts offer financial independence. People with disabilities and their families can save for a variety of expenses in these tax-advantaged accounts. In 2014, federal legislation paved the way for states to offer ABLE accounts, tax-advantaged plans that allow individuals with disabilities to save for ongoing expenses without threatening their eligibility for crucial government support, such as supplemental security income or Social Security disability insurance. Previously, people with disabilities had to have less than $2,000 in total assets to maintain their eligibility for these programs, which made it difficult for them to live independently. As is the case with 529 College Savings Accounts, ABLE accounts, the acronym stands for Achieving a Better Life Experience, grow tax-free, and earnings aren't taxed as long as the money goes towards qualified disability expenses. The maximum annual contribution to an ABLE account rose to $16,000 on January 1st. The limit, which is tied to IRS gift tax exclusion, has been capped at $15,000 since 2018. All but four states, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, offer ABLE programs, and if you live in a state that doesn't offer one, you can create an account offered by another state. How to qualify. Anyone with disability who receives disability-related benefits, such as SSI or SSDI, or who can produce a certification from a doctor that states their disability is marked and severe, can open an ABLE account with one major caveat. The individual disability must have occurred prior to his or her 26th birthday. Congress is considering legislation that would extend the age of onset from 26 to 46. If enacted, the legislation would likely double the number of people who qualify for ABLE accounts, says Mary Morris, chief executive of ABLE Now, an ABLE program offered by Virginia. It would hit a really large group of working people with disabilities and those who we think benefit most from the ABLE account, Morris said. Contributions to an ABLE account can come from anyone, friends, family, even strangers, so long as they don't total more than $16,000 in 1 year. And many states allow residents a state tax deduction for a portion of their contribution to their own state's plan, Morris says. Michigan, for example, allows residents to contribute to its ABLE account to deduct up to $5,000 or $10,000 for a married couple. Minimum contributions to ABLE accounts vary from state to state, but generally they're as low as $5 to $50. If you have unused funds in a 529 college savings account, you can roll over the money to an ABLE account. If you go this route, you can still use the money for college, but you can also use it for qualified ABLE account expenses. The list of qualifying expenses is broad and includes basic living expenses, health and wellness programs, housing, transportation, vehicle expenses, education and training, assistive technology, and even financial management. People are now saving for home and small business startups costs as well. Disability-related expenses, such as an electric-powered wheelchair or scooter, anything that someone wants to, as the name suggests, achieve a better life experience, says Tom Foley, a financial planner and executive director of the National Disability Institute, Individuals can also use these accounts to build up an emergency savings. All right, Emma Patch, and that is from Kiplinger's. Next, from Money. Banking, two updates to credit reports. Credit reports are getting a couple of significant tweaks. Information from Buy Now, Pay Later, BNPL is the symbol, firm will now be added to consumer credit reports from the three major credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. And some medical debt information will be removed. Consumers with medical debt should see their scores increase starting in July. Medical debt that was sent to collections but eventually paid off will be removed from all of the reports. Plus, any medical debt you incur won't show up on your credit report until a year after it's sent to a collection. Currently, collection reports start to show an unpaid medical account 180 days after it's sent to collections. And it can stay on your credit report for up to 7 years after you've paid off the debt. BNPL tracking, BNPL firms, including Affirm, Klarna, and Afterpay, offer you a loan at the checkout counter to cover your purchase. Until now, credit bureaus didn't track such loans, and it's not clear exactly how BNPL information will factor into credit scoring formulas, says Matt Schultz, chief credit analyst at LendingTree, an online loan marketplace. People who pay their installment loans on time could see their score go up, and tracking the loans may give some people a score who didn't even have one before. However, if you miss a payment or take out a lot of these short-term loans, the hit to both the payment history and the credit history sides of the credit scoring algorithm could cause your score to drop. Payment history accounts for 35% of your FICO score, with length of credit history accounting for 15%. And if your BNPL loans boost your utilization ratio, how much of your available credit you are using, that could affect your score as well. If you plan on using a BNPL loan, it's a good idea to set up an automatic payment from your checking account or debit card to pay it off as soon as possible. For more information on how to troubleshoot your credit report, see How to Create Wealth, the May edition in Kiplinger's. From the Wall Street Journal, Monday's issue, the 23rd, Abbott CEO issues an apology for role in baby formula gap. Abbott Laboratories chief executive Robert Ford apologized for his company's role in the nationwide shortage of baby formula and promises production will ramp back up in June. "We're sorry for every family we've let down," Mr. Ford wrote in a Washington Post op-ed on Saturday. Mr. Ford explained what led to his company's voluntary recall of baby formula and detailed the company's plan to avoid a similar shortage in the future. In February, Abbott Laboratories voluntarily recalled some of its Similac Alimentum and Elicare formulas manufactured in its Sturgis, Michigan plant, after the Food and Drug Administration officials found a potentially deadly bacteria there. The decision, exacerbated by existing baby formula shortages created by the supply chain issues during COVID-19 pandemic, Mr. Ford acknowledged, "We take great pride in manufacturing nutrition and formula to feed America's infants, including our most vulnerable," Mr. Ford said. "But the past few months have distressed us, as they have you, and so I want to say we're sorry to every family we've let down since our voluntary recall exacerbated our nation's baby formula shortage. Four infants who drank tainted baby formula were hospitalized, and two of them died. However, the FDA said that the bacteria didn't match the strains found at the Abbott lab, at the Abbott plant." Nonetheless, Mr. Ford wrote, "Issuing a voluntary recall was the right thing to do. The FDA's investigation did discover a bacteria in our plant that we will not tolerate. I have high expectations that this company, I have high expectations of this company, and we fell short of them. We will not take risks when it comes to the health of children. The shortage has led to many empty shelves in some stores, product restrictions and panic among parents and caregivers searching for formula to feed their babies. President Biden on Wednesday invoked the Defense Production Act to increase production of baby formula and launch a program called Operation Fly Formula that would bring supplies of cargo planes that meet U.S. standards from overseas. On Sunday, Mr. Biden tweeted photos of an aircraft being loaded with supplies. "Our team is working around the clock to get safe formula to everyone who needs it," Mr. Biden wrote on Twitter moments before the first formula shipments arrived in Indiana on Sunday. A top White House official said on Sunday, defended the administration's approach to the shortages and blamed longer-term trends for the crisis. "How do we end up in a market where we have three companies that control 90% of the market?" the director of the White House National Economic Council, Brian Deese, said on CNN, adding that officials were weighing steps to open up the market to more competition. "We're going to have to work on that," Mr. Deese said. Mr. Deese also said that the first shipment of formula brought to Indiana from Germany accounted for around 15% of the national need, and that he expected additional such flights earlier this week. "We're going to keep ramping up until we get there," he said. Abbott's Mr. Ford said the company plans to restart its Sturgis facility in early June after entering into a consent decree with the FDA. "It will take 6 to 8 weeks from that time for the production to begin to get the products on the shelves." Meanwhile, he said, the company is putting baby formula production ahead of all its other adult products at its Ohio plant and has flown in supplies from its facility in Ireland. Specialized baby formula, known as Elicare, for infants or children who can't digest other formulas and milks, is the priority, Mr. Ford said. Okay, from the Wall Street Journal, U.S. News. Recession risk entangles Biden's strategy. The Federal Reserve efforts to slow inflation are raising the possibility of higher unemployment, a slower growth economy, and recession prospects that could create new headaches for the Biden administration. As the country heads into midterm election season, Democrats are trying to talk about the economic growth and robust employment. Republicans are talking about damaging impact of inflation. More recently, warnings about the prospect of an economic turndown, which could come in 2023 according to some estimates, have complicated the economic picture in a new way. Mr. Biden and his advisors are already grappling with inflation trending near a four-decade high. Wavering consumer confidence and headwinds posed by Russia's war in Ukraine. Republicans lay the blame for surging prices at the administration, saying it stoked inflation with pandemic-related stimulus, then failed to counter its price as prices rose. They have lambasted Mr. Biden and the Democratic lawmakers ahead of this fall's midterm election that will decide the party that controls Congress. It is the president and all Democratic government who have drained American families' pocketbooks, and every poll shows our citizens understand the sad reality all too well, says Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, recently said on the Senate floor. Mr. Biden and his economic team have maintained the economy is well positioned to withstand challenging points, pointing to factors such as strong labor market and unemployment trending near a 50-year low. They are deploying a strategy seeking to improve American view of the economy, which could bolster confidence and help underpin consumer spending. Our economy is in a transition from what it had been the strongest recovery in modern American history to what can be a period of more stable and resilient growth that works better for families, Brian Drees, the director of National Economic Council, said Sunday on CNN. The strategy includes Mr. Biden increasing travel domestically to tout economic bright spots of the administration's efforts to lower consumer pricing. He is also drawing starker contrast between his economic policy agenda and that of the Republicans, who the administration says would do little to combat inflation and seek to raise taxes on American families. It's an economy with some real headwinds, but American households are facing those headwinds from a position of strength, said Jared Bernstein, member of the White House's Council of Economic Advisors. The White House faces two hurdles. Economic concerns rate highly among voters, so its message about the strength of the economy risks falling flat. The changing of the direction of the economy is only partially within the administration's control, with the strongest levers held by the Fed. The central bank is mounting an aggressive effort to tame inflation without substantially slowing the labor market and the broader economy, a feat that some economists say may be difficult to accomplish. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said to the Wall Street Journal last week that there could be some pain involved in bringing down inflation, and that unemployment might rise slightly. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen last Wednesday said the outlook for the global economy is challenging and that higher food prices and energy prices are having stagflation effects, referring to a combination of high inflation and weak growth. U.S. stocks tumbled sharply last week. On Sunday, Mr. Dee said the White House supported the Fed's approach. We need to give the Fed the space and the independence to do its job, which is to get inflation under control. Mr. Bernstein at the White House said the pandemic has created a set of economic circumstances that don't readily fit into the traditional calculations about whether a recession is on the horizon. Mr. Biden, for his part, has continued to push for the next phase of the economic agenda, calling for higher taxes on the wealthy and larger corporations, in part to help fund investments in social programs. The administration argues would help lower everyday costs for families. Mr. Biden has been unable to win congressional approval for that agenda amid concerns from Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, and Republicans who say more spending will stoke more inflation. Also from the Wall Street Journal, investors struggle to identify market bottoms as stocks fall. U.S. stocks are in the midst of the largest sell-off in decades. Whether they are close to the bottom is anyone's guess. Market sell-offs have long stumped strategists trying to predict when they're close to done. Some have concluded with bursts of panic selling. Others, such as in the one lasting from 1973 to 1974, grounded to the end of days and subdued trading volumes. Many investors and analysts looking back at historic pullbacks believe the current slump that has put the S&P 500 on the cusp of a bear market still has a way to go. The index is down 19% from January 3rd record, flirting with 20% decline that would end a bull market that began in March of 2020. This year's stock sell-off, now in its fifth month, has already gone on far longer than a typical pullback occurring without a recession, according to Deutsche Bank. Yet the Federal Reserve is still in the early stages of its campaign to raise interest rates, meaning that financial conditions will tighten further and put more pressure on stocks in the coming months. Many people are skeptical that the central bank will be able to keep raising rates without tipping the economy into a recession, a period when stocks have typically fallen about 30% going back to 1929. According to Dow Jones market data. Data has continued to suggest that this year's sell-off, while painful, hasn't yet resulted in the types of shifts in investor behavior seen in prior downturns. Investors continue to have a hefty chunk of their portfolios in the stock market. Bank of America Corp. said this month that its private clients have averaged 63% of their portfolio dedicated to stocks, far more than that of the 2008 financial crisis when they had 39% of their portfolio in stocks. A measure of expected market volatility has remained firmly below levels it breached during prior sell-offs. The CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, jumped well above 40 during the sell-off in March 2020, November 2008, and August 2011. It has yet to close above that level this year. Investors haven't rushed out of some of the most beaten down parts of the market. The ARK Innovation Exchange Traded Fund has pulled in a net inflow of $1.4 billion this year, despite being on track to deliver the worst returns in its history, according to FactSet. Leverage ETFs that offer investors a way to amplify bullish bets on the NASDAQ, as well as semiconductor stocks, have drawn in billions of dollars in inflows this year. We still need to shake out the froth from the market, said Cole Smead, president of portfolio managers of Smead Capital Management. Like many other investors, Mr. Smead has been trying to identify businesses with attractive valuations that he believes can withstand rising inflation and slowing growth. One company Mr. Smead has been eyeing is Starbucks Company. Shares which the firm previously owned, but like almost everything else in the stock market, the coffee's chain shares have declined this year. Starbucks shares are down 37% on course for the worst year since 2008. S&P 500 is down 18% for the year, posted its seventh straight weekly loss Friday, its longest such streak since 2001. Things are going to keep getting worse before they get better, Mr. Smead said. One reason many investors are cautious right now, soaring inflation. The Fed is raising interest rates to try to rein in inflation, which earlier this year rose at the fastest pace since 1980s. It's aiming to pull off a soft landing, in other words, slow the economy enough to rein in inflation but avoid tipping the U.S. into a recession. Many investors fear the central banks won't succeed based on prior cycles of tightening monetary policy. Going back to the 1980s, the U.S. slipped into a recession four of the six times the Fed kicked off interest rate increases campaigns, according to research from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. This time around, the central bank has added the challenge of trying to bring price increases under control, while Russia's invasion of Ukraine and China's zero COVID policy add to supply chain disruptions and inflationary pressures worldwide. There's not a chance in hell the Fed will be able to crush inflation without significantly impairing domestic demand, said David Rosenberg, president, chief economics of Rosenberg Research. Mr. Rosenberg said that he believes the markets have a hard time finding a definite bottom before the Fed is done tightening monetary policy. It has convinced investors it's succeeding in bringing inflationary pressures down without risking a recession. Others note the stocks declines, while painful haven't yet reached the severity of prior bear markets. Going back to 1929, the S&P 500 has declined an average of 36% during bear markets. According to data from NedDV Research, the end of the sell-off will be a great buying opportunity, but I don't think that moment will necessarily be tomorrow, Mr. Smead said. All right, so I have one section that I'm hoping we can get through most of it. Series I savings bonds, readers ask. We answer questions about how long you have to hold them. Popular investments backed by the U.S. government recently became even more attractive, especially for tax-smart investors who are worried about inflation. I wrote about tax advantages and other aspects of Series I bonds in a column earlier this year. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The column guaranteed a lot of follow-up questions from the Wall Street Journal readers. The popularity of these investments is likely to continue, the U.S. Treasury announcing a few weeks ago the initial annualized rate of new I-Series savings bonds sold from May through October of this year is 9.62%. To be sure, no investment is perfect for anyone, but Series I bonds have so many attractive features that they represent an absolute superb investment opportunity, says Burton Mikal, author of the investment classic A Random Walk Down Wall Street. So here are answers to some of those readers' questions, as well as other queries that investors may have about the bonds. If I buy these Series I savings bonds, what's the minimum amount of time I have to hold them? At least 1 year. If you can't afford to lock up your money at least that long, these bonds aren't for you. But if you can, keep in mind that they can continue to earn interest for 30 years or until you decide to cash them in, whichever comes first. If you redeem them before 5 years, you lose interest from the previous 3 months. For example, if you cash in a bond after 18 months, you only get 15 months worth of interest. If I buy now and I'm guaranteed to get the 9.62 rate for as long as I hold the bonds, no. The 9.62 rate is only the initial annualized rate on new I bonds sold from May through October this year. The rate is applied to 6 months after the purchase is made. The Treasury site says, for example, if you buy an I bond July 1st, 2022, the 9.62 rate would be applied through January 2023. Interest is compounded semi-annually. The Treasury resets the rate every 6 months based on formulas led by inflation. Since nobody knows precisely what will happen on the inflation front, we don't know today what the new initial rate will be starting in November. Rate updates affect both new and previously issued bonds, a Treasury spokesperson said. The composite interest rate and applied to Series I bonds is updated every 6 months when the bond is issued until the bond matures. For some details on how the bonds earn interest, see the Treasury website. Okay, we have about 1 minute left. Are there limits on how much these bonds I'm allowed to buy each year? Yes. The annual limit is $10,000 per person, according to the Treasury. You can buy these bonds in electronic form from treasury.gov, or you can also buy them. You can also, treasury.com, and you can also buy up to an additional $5,000 a year in paper bonds. I bonds by using also federal income tax refunds. Also, many investors buy Series I bonds not only for themselves, but for gifts to relatives. If you buy them as a gift, the purchase amount counts towards the annual limit of the recipient. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to listen next time. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.